You know, we are facing some interesting times, and when we get into the Scriptures, to me it's an amazing how God answers right where we are. For example, I mean, we are facing some challenging times. We don't know what's going to happen right now with the nuclear situation in Iran and how tenuous it is in the Middle East. And our president seems to be impotent to deal with Iran and Russia. It seems like we're giving ground and giving ground and giving ground. There's a lot more deaths now occurring in Afghanistan, and troops that they need are, you know, they're calling for. It's just a confusing time. The healthcare debate in this nation, there's a lot on the plate, and people are trying to figure out really what's happening. Some are basically saying, hey, the sky is falling, and others are saying, oh, no, this is the brave new world. And somewhere in the middle, you know, I think the truth lies. But I think in many ways as Christians, we have to keep our heads above this and know that God is working even if it seems outside the boundaries of what we normally would expect. One of the most shocking things for Jeremiah to deal with was when God told him that ultimately God was going to use Babylon to humble his people. And when I think of this nation and I think of the history, the generations of people, the more missionary dollars go out into all the world from America than any other place. But so do pornography dollars, and so do drug dollars, and so do many other evil things. And largely we have slipped back, we've fallen farther and farther away from the things of God. Just like his people did in Jeremiah and Isaiah, as they record, more and more they were backsliding, more and more they were forgetting who they were. And ultimately, after all of the small warnings and disasters and situations and problems and perplexities, that didn't get their attention. Eventually, the Lord told Jeremiah, that's it. Babylon is going to come. They're going to be captive for 70 years. And that's the way it's going to be. There's nothing that can change that. And so this very patriotic young man had to say, we're going to be defeated. Now, can you imagine that kind of message coming to America? And yet, in many ways, I think we've sown the wind. We're reaping the whirlwind. So Jesus, you know, in dealing with us, really, the amazing thing is we can still have, as a person, as an individual, a promise, a future, a hope, that calling in our lives, the assurance, no matter what happens in the world, though the mountains fall down, the valleys are lifted up, the Lord just makes it a straight way for those who followed him. And so we find Jesus in ministering. He'd already been attacked for not following traditions. They were saying, hey, you even washed your hands, the last passage, if you remember. And Jesus essentially says, hey, what goes into a man isn't defiling him, it's what comes out of him. Eating with one unwashed hands does not defile you, but what comes from with your heart. All of the, you know, as he describes, the adulteries and evil thoughts and fornications and murders and thefts and all those things. So he left off with that, and then after this confrontation, it says in verse 24 that he arose and went to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and wanted no one to know it. But he could not be hidden. He leaves the region completely. People are divided. The religious leaders are frustrated with him. There's lots of tension. Multitudes have their needs, but they're not really seeking for the truth. And the disciples, if you remember, they haven't had rest in a long time. In fact, they tried to get some rest, and that's when they came back and they found the 5,000 they needed to feed, and one thing led to another, and a constant barrage of ministry. And now Jesus is taking them away out of the region, which is really an unclean area for the Orthodox, strict Jewish person. They wouldn't travel in these areas. They certainly wouldn't live or seek hospitality in this pagan area of Tyre and Sidon. These were the Sidonians, or really Matthew calls them just Canaanites. They were the peoples of the land, but not of Israel. Well, it says he entered a house and wanted no one to know it. Obviously, they're seeking rest. They're trying to keep a low key. But it says, but he could not be hidden. You know, I love that, actually. You know, there's something about the smell of a rose that even if you hid it in your room, you can't really hide it. The fragrance will diffuse. And it's true in our lives as Christians. When we're truly walking in the Spirit, it is obvious. You bring the fragrance of Christ, in a sense. And wherever Jesus went, there was something about him that stood out. It was said of R.C. Chapman, who was a godly man. Spurgeon called him back in the 1820s the saintliest man I ever knew. In the mid-1800s, he was traveling in Spain and just minding his own business, and a Spanish couple was arguing, you know, having a marital spat right there in the train. And the woman defending herself, according to the reporters who eventually recorded this in his biography, one of the women said in defending herself to her husband, you know, I'm pure in this situation. I'm just like that holy man sitting over there. And she pointed to this guy. She didn't know who he was. But there was something that just stood out. And I think in many ways, Jesus, wherever he went, the word had already went, he was a household name throughout all of Israel and the surrounding areas. But how did they know he was the one? I think as Jesus traveled with his disciples, there was something about his countenance that just breathed of he is not living for himself. He's for others. And word spread quickly. So he couldn't be hidden. You know, it's funny how many people will actually seek publicity. Sometimes we, you know, depend way too much on advertising and, you know, this or that to get the word out. And frankly, I loved what Gail Irwin had said on our 25th anniversary. He said, this church is one of the most well-hidden churches he's ever been at. Down here in this road, no sign out of the main road, and yet still people are here. And I think that's because of the fragrance of Christ, that you, as you're growing in the Lord, you're expressing throughout wherever you are. And that is effective. That's a testimony. It's like, listen, you know, when you're on fire for God, people will want to come out and watch you burn. They'll want to come out and see what's going on. And I think with Jesus, that's what was happening. When you touch people's lives, you can't hide if you want to. But now we come to a very interesting encounter. In fact, one of the most strange encounters, one of the most controversial, one of the most difficult to comprehend, so out of character with Jesus, it doesn't make sense to us on the surface. The only problem is we can't really hear the tone of his voice or see the look in his face. So just reading it on paper, it seems very harsh and insensitive and cruel. But there's something deeper happening here. And I submit to you, as we consider Jesus ministering beyond the borders, that there's something here for us. Outside of the normal. You know, listen, we sometimes fall into the trap of, you know, same old, you know, walking, and we get into our ruts. And, you know, the only difference between a rut and a grave is the length and the depth. That's about the only difference. We get into our ruts, and we don't really think things through. And sometimes the Lord shakes us up. And I think that this is a great picture of this. A woman, and of course these people were related to the Canaanites. A woman, it says in verse 25, had a daughter, a young daughter, who had an unclean spirit. She heard about him. She heard about Jesus. Somehow or another she connects, this is the one. And she came and fell at his feet. Now he's trying to keep a low key. He's in this house. Maybe he's in the courtyard. And this woman comes, just knows it's him. And the woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth. And she kept asking him to cast the demon out of her daughter. Now the clue here, the little thing that just stands out, which seems odd, is the phrase, kept asking him. Now shouldn't that strike you strange, kept asking him? Every person that has ever come up to Jesus up to this point and asked for something, it was like, bang, immediate. He was so quick to answer. The leper comes to him, you know, if you're willing, you can make me clean. I'm willing, be clean. You know, just there was no hesitation. In fact, if a sick person didn't come up to him, he went up to them. Jesus and a hurting person, they were like a magnet. But now you have this weird thing happening. This woman keeps asking him, keeps, well, Lord, don't you hear? Are you... Now, Matthew records a little bit more on this, and it says that his disciples, she kept asking, have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter's severely demon-possessed, Matthew records in Matthew 15. And the disciples finally are like, you know, what's going on? They urge Jesus, send her away, for she cries out after us. She's crying after us now. So this woman was just persistent. Help me, my daughter, come on, please, don't... And Jesus apparently is ignoring her. And the disciples are like, well, send her away, if you're not going to help her, she's bugging us now. Very, very odd situation. What is going on here? Turning a deaf ear to cries for help, that doesn't seem like Jesus. Now, there's been made explanations over this, that Jesus actually says in Matthew 15, 24, he says, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Matthew records. Was that the reason why he just sent to the Jewish people? Well, he helped the Roman centurion. He helped other Greeks in the land of Israel. So he's making a blockade. He's making a barrier for this woman. Why is he doing that? Why isn't he just ministering to her? Some have said that maybe performing the miracle would have defeated his purpose for rest and relaxation, and it would have just brought more people. So he's just tired and I can't deal with it anymore. Yeah, I think I have a hard time with that one. I don't see that as a very realistic explanation. Nothing about this makes sense to us reading it. Perhaps it was just a timing issue. Perhaps, I mean, you could say, okay, his ultimate destiny is the cross, that where he can help the whole world. And if he doesn't keep some limitation in what he does throughout the world, now he'll never end up in the cross. Someone will take him from by force in another nation. You know, the future blessing of the world, maybe it was best to confine his ministry to the Jewish nation and even more so the 12. But he's there. And it just seems odd. So maybe we can explain the avoidance. Maybe, you know what, it wouldn't have been best for the ministry ultimately for this woman to be helped. If you can explain the avoidance, you have a real difficult time with the harsh words coming up. Verse 27, Jesus said to her, "Let the children be filled first, for it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." Well, now we have a problem. You know, like the cursing of the fig tree, kind of leaves us a bit stunned how Jesus speaks to this woman. It's not like him, first ignoring her and then speaking kind of harshly to her. Now, I know some have said, well, you know, it wasn't like the Gentiles. The Gentiles were likened to wild dogs, and this was a different word. This is a diminutive. This is a little dog. So he's softening a little bit. And maybe there are some things we miss. Maybe we don't see his eyes and how he's looking at her. Maybe we don't see his tone. And there is a little clue here. Let the children be filled first. There's a little bit of a hope there. Yes, the bread is going to come to everybody eventually, but let the children be filled first. It's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. Or was it just that Jesus is testing her faith? I think there's more here. I hate giving titles to messages too early because I don't know if I fully digested this passage before I had to give the title to the media ministry. And I titled this Beyond Boundaries, which again, he's ministering beyond the boundaries here. He's also going to be ministering beyond the boundaries of normal ministry. So it does fit in this sense. But I think that the real message here is this woman's response to Jesus' seemingly harsh words. And in many ways, we can put ourselves in the mix here and discover, and if you haven't already, there are times when the Lord doesn't respond in the way that you think he should in your own life. He said no when you thought he should have said yes. It's been hard when you thought it should have been a little easier. It seems like his hand isn't there to help you in the midst of your desperate need. Have you not experienced this? What is the reason? Why? Why does the Lord make it hard on this woman? Why seem so harsh? Why so cruel? Well, her answer is surprising to me. She answered and said, "Yes, Lord. Yet even the little dogs under the table eat from the children's crumbs." Well, then he said to her, "For this saying, go your way. The demon has gone out of your daughter." And when she came to her house, she found the demon gone out and her daughter lying on the bed. Mark doesn't waste any words, just to the point. She got what she wanted. Very strange response. I listen to this woman, and essentially what she's receiving from Jesus is kind of humiliating. You know, a proud soul would not have endured that kind of response from Jesus. They would have remained on unbended knee and unbroken heart and went away empty. You know, it's interesting how that is our main problem, isn't it? The unbended knee, the unbroken heart, the proud soul. The proud soul, his soul is not right in him, the Proverbs say. There's something wrong with the proud soul. The Bible tells us, of course, pride goes before the fall. Pride is our biggest enemy. It's the thing that clinched Eve's going after the fruit. It was pleasant to the eyes. It was good for food. But it was the fact that she knew that this eating that fruit would make her wise. The appeal of Satan, you will be like God. knowing good and evil. That was what clinched it in the temptation. And I think in many ways, that's what we stumble over the most. I'm not surprised in my own life of how hard I was toward God, to the point where I adopted, because of the music and the culture and the spirit of the age, I'd adopted a position, I would rather go to hell than bow my knee to God. That's what I said. That's what I thought. That's what I believed. I just didn't know the God that I was saying that about. And I think that in many ways, you know, listen, mothers, you see this in toddlers, the need for that will to be bent and broken. Not the spirit broken, but the will. The will needs to be come under control. You know, that toddler, that unbroken will and defiance. I want a cookie. No, you must eat your vegetables first. No, I want a cookie. And they'll close their mouth and they'll tighten their lips as you're trying to give them a piece of broccoli. And they'll fight you to the death. They'll be starving. And you know they're hungry, and your mom's heart goes out, he's got to eat something, okay, I'll give you a cookie first. Bad mistake. But we do it. You know, it's a mom being a mom sometimes. It's tough. And in many ways, Jesus, of course, I mean, he's the perfect parent. He knows exactly what we need, and this is why I believe he is so strong with this woman. You see, this response of the woman, fact is, insult or not, she's not put off by this. Because maybe it's the desperation of the situation. And coupled with the fact she knows Jesus can do something. So she's not touched by this personally. See, the response to me tells me she accepts the judgment. She says, yes, Lord. Okay, I am a little dog. I don't deserve anything. You do want to minister to your own people. I have no right. I have no claim. I can't demand anything from you. You're right. Yes, Lord. Now, can you come to that conclusion in your life? Yes, Lord? Okay, Lord, so I am in this pickle. I am in this predicament, and you're not answering, and you want me to be here, and I deserve it. I have no claim on you. I can't demand you to rescue me. And accepting the judgment in a way. Then she enters into what I consider a battle of wits. And you know, this was not unusual in the Eastern world. They loved the clever little retorts. And she responds, yes, Lord, but even the little dogs under the table eat from the children's crumbs. Her faith is evident. Even as the insult comes, she persists. Young people, I want to share something with you right now. Listen, it's not unusual in this middle-class culture we live in to, at the age between 14, 13, and 20, it's like you expect everything in life to be handed to you because, frankly, up to this point, everything in life has been handed to you. And you come to a point where heaven is not going to make it easy on you. And you're going to be tempted to say, forget it, I'm out of here. You have to remember you live in a bubble. Your parents may have been unwise to cater to your needs and give you everything you wanted, making it easy on you, not making you work, not making you be responsible for what you need to be responsible for. But nonetheless, it's only going to be harder now because the later in life you learn the lessons, the harder they are. And I think in many ways, this nation is going to go through some difficult times and there's going to be some testing. Now, none of you are starving. Yeah, we complain, you know, if the least of things go wrong. I'm amazed what kids have. They're walking around. I shared with the youth on Friday night. I says, you know, most of you kids have cell phones. What's up with that? I never had a cell phone when I was your age. If I did, it would have been about 10 feet tall. I mean, I had to carry on a battery of a suitcase, you know, and it wouldn't have really been much. And we complain. We had to dial on those. I remember the rotary phones growing up with the little phones, and I always hated, one comedian put it this way, I never liked to dial people that had too many zeros in their number. What's up with that? It takes too long. I'm not calling you anymore. Now we have little cell phones, dee, 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 and you know, it delays for a second, and we get all impatient. Life is handed to us so much. So listen, if heaven says no, can you handle that? In a way, heaven is saying no to this woman. Sorry. It's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. Harsh, cold, insensitive. You know, in your approach to God, if He doesn't answer you in the way that you expect or hope, do you get discouraged? Do you leave? Do you say, I'm not going to believe anymore? I know one young man who claimed that he prayed and prayed and cried unto God all night one time to be filled with the Spirit and no answer from heaven. And from that point, he made up his mind. There is no God. If there were a God, he would have answered that young man in desperation. I can't believe there's a God. I can't believe anybody would let a young man go through that torture and have no answer, so God can't be there. And he came to that conclusion, as sadly many in this generation, in their haughty pride, are doing. Yet this woman accepts her judgment. Yes, Lord. Now, I know in my own life, I want to share a little personal side to this for me. There was a time in my life I was desperate as a Christian. I was empty. I felt like no longer were the words of God ministering to me. I'd read my Bible and it was just dead. I'd go to church and I just felt nothing. I was at my wit's end. I was crying unto God, man. I was praying. I was up my reading. I didn't get it, but I was just, God help me, you know, and I was getting nothing from heaven. I didn't have that joy of my salvation anymore. Everything just seemed to be a drudgery and empty. And something clicked. Something hit me. Might have been the devotion I was reading by Andrew Murray called Waiting on God. He's got great devotionals, and something clicked in me, and I essentially thought all of a sudden, who am I to expect God to jump when I call? If he wants me to just be quiet and wait because he knows what's better, then I'm going to have to accept that. If he chooses to answer, fine. If he doesn't, I'll just have to wait patient until he comes. And a breaking point came. That moment I made up my mind that I had no right to demand anything from God at all. The eternal God would answer, would move when he saw it was fit and not before. And at that point, I resolved in my mind, okay, God, yes, Lord. I accept that judgment. Maybe it's been my pride when I thought I was God's gift to the ministry. Maybe it was my attitude that, you know, God, aren't you glad to have me on your team? Maybe I thought he owed me because I was studying and reading and going to church regularly. Whatever it might have been, I finally broke and said, okay, God, I'm okay. I'll wait outside your door and maybe some crumbs will fall from your table from time to time. If that's how you want it to be, I'm okay with that. Because I have no right. My once proud soul was humbled, and I accepted that whatever he would do, if he wanted to use me in his ministry, fine. If he wanted me to be a nobody, fine. Lord, it's your call. Something deeply changed in me at that moment, I have to say, some 30-some years ago. And I was ready. Whatever. At that moment of surrender, something happened to me. I was free from the tyranny of self. At that moment, I sensed a smile from heaven, which I had not sensed in almost a year of my striving. And to this day, I'll tell you, it's been an indelible lesson for me. That period of time of emptiness, groping, trying to find God and nothing, and then finally having to resolve, Lord, I have no right. I have no demand on you. I can't expect you to jump when I call. Now, on the other side, there is faith. Now, I don't want you to mistake this. You see, my faith kept me going and keep putting money in the bank to collect interest, so to speak. You know, the parable where the man was given a talent and one went out and doubled it, another went out and tripled it, another went out and was afraid because he thought his master was harsh and hard and expecting. And he took that talent and he buried it. And he gave it back. He says, here's your talent. I didn't want to mess with it. And he says, you should have at least put it in the bank to collect interest. So there I was in my emptiness and thinking, you know what, look, I can't expect God to do anything, but I'm going to keep reading my Bible. I'm going to keep going to church. I'm going to keep, Lord, and if you answer, fine. If not, fine. I have no right or demand on you, but I believe that you will bring this out in your point. And what kept me going to church, what kept me seeking the Lord, even though I felt nothing, was just what this woman did. She was desperate. She had nowhere else to go. And she believed. And so she was, okay, I accept that. I don't know right. But even the little dogs get some crumbs. And I love that faith. Don't you see that? Doesn't that warm your heart? This woman, listen, if you have trouble with God being your authority, this is going to really bother you. If you think you're doing God a favor by being here in church this morning, this is going to really annoy you. This story will not set well with you. And that's exactly why you need to see it. Because you need to see yourself. You need to see that it's by grace you've been saved through faith, not of yourselves. It's the gift of God. It is pure grace. And he has called you into his marvelous light. And some of you are not in his marvelous light. You're here, but you're not in him. Because you're still striving with your Maker. interesting, when I finally surrendered, it really was a quick answer. That light flooded my soul. I was broken again. That peace, that joy returned. And I'm thankful. And I tell you, it left such a powerful lesson from 30 years ago that I can't take any credit for anything. Dare I? I'd be back where I was in that joyless, empty, proudful state. I'll tell you, I'm afraid of that. I still, for 30 years, that lesson was so powerful, I never want to go back there. I never want to experience that again. I want to remember who I am and who He is. And that's why I love the story of this woman. Can't take anything for granted. And you know what? God answered. Her daughter was healed. Just no fanfare, just go home. Your daughter's healed. It'll be done for you. I just love it. She goes home and finds her daughter's healed. Well, verse 31 picks up another story, and were it not the fact that there is a tie-in here, I would just let you simmer on this one. But departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, he came through the midst in the region of Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee. Now, he'd been to Decapolis before. If you remember, one of the cities of Decapolis, he was nearby when he cast the demons out of that man, and they ran into the pigs, and the pigs went down and drowned themselves. What did they say there in the region of Decapolis to Jesus? Was, please leave. We don't want you here. A little too freaked out. So what did he say to the man who wanted to follow him? Go and tell all your friends what great things the Lord has done. Now, Mark does not tell us a whole lot of what happened when he came back to Decapolis. He just tells us about one deaf and mute man. Matthew tells us that there was an innumerable number of people that were bringing everybody to him there in Decapolis, where once they told him leave, now everybody's coming. Why? I have to think that it was that man who Jesus said, go and tell all your friends, that he did. He did. So he went through all of Decapolis. And that's why now when Jesus comes back, he's welcome. Listen, do you know that that is exactly what we're called to do? There are regions in this Northeast. There are regions in other countries. There are regions all over the place where God, the God of the Bible, is not welcome. Leave. Get your Bible, get your stuff, and get out of here. But yet, the power of a changed life is a compelling argument to rethink that position. Hence, in some of the most closed countries, in China, in Iran, do you know that in Morocco, where Christianity is cool, if you want to be a Christian, that's fine. We're mostly Muslim here, but if you want to serve Jesus, that's fine. There's very little happening. In Iran, where it is life-threatening to be a Christian and death to lead somebody from Islam to Christianity, they're coming to Christians like by the thousands. It's amazing because I think it's a little more evident in Iran. When God touches a heart, it's powerful. And like that man that was touched, he went, and now Jesus is welcome, though they're not welcomed by the government. Of course, our own government is basically saying Jesus isn't welcome either anymore. But there's something powerfully compelling about a changed life. And I submit to you that as Jesus comes back, all these people are coming. Well, Mark just focuses on one. And I think because Peter, who gave his account to Mark, John Mark traveled there and Peter kind of gave him these reports. Peter is the source. What stood out in his mind more than anything was this one man. They brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech. And they begged him to put his hand on him. And he took him aside from the multitude and he put his fingers in his ears and he spat and touched his tongue. And then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, now, I don't know how many of you ever had trouble with this word, but I sure have had. And I was told by an Arabic-speaking person that's similar in Aramaic. It's ifatha, the PHPH, what I want to say, ifatha. It's actually just one F, ifatha. So he said ifatha. Now, that doesn't really do anything for you this morning, but I thought I'd tell you that anyway. Meaning be opened. Simple statement, be opened. And that stuck in Peter's mind. Just said, be opened. Well, immediately his ears were open, and the impediment of his tongue was loosed, and he spoke plainly. And then he commanded them that they should tell no one, but the more he commanded them, the more widely they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He makes both the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. So he's back in the region of Decapolis. And now he touches this man, this one man. Interesting account, though. A little odd, a little beyond the borders, if you will. He takes the man aside privately. Perhaps because, you know, it's a little embarrassing. The man can't hear, he can't speak. He puts his fingers in his ears, he spat and touched his tongue, he looked up to heaven and groaned in spirit, and he spoke, "Be open." Now, is it possible that Jesus is just essentially doing a little sign language with the man? He can't hear, so he can't say anything that the man will hear, so he sign language, he touches his ears. He spits and touches his tongue. There's a little bit of expression here where the man is now has an opportunity to exercise faith, to believe something's going to happen. And then Jesus looks up into heaven. You know, it's just looking up to heaven, looking upward. Groans in his spirit. What a great picture. And then spoke, "Be opened." You know, I often wondered about this spitting because in pagan cultures, they sometimes assign power to spit. Witch doctors. There's a missionary story that's quite interesting. When a group of missionaries came to an area where these witch doctors had sway, and they were trying to bring the gospel, but the witch doctors were very unimpressed with Jesus. And as they're listening to the stories, they came to this story where Jesus spat, and they said, what was that? Read that again. And Jesus spat and then touched his tongue and his ears. He said, "Be open," and he could hear and he could speak immediately. And the witch doctors, all of a sudden, they changed their countenance. And they said, "Jesus is the most powerful spitter in the world." Because in that culture, spitting, you know, the power of spit. Now, when you're a boy, you know, spit is fun too, even though you're told not to spit. But as a witch doctor, you have power in your spit. And to be a powerful spitter would be one that could change lives. And here, all of a sudden, maybe that's why the Lord allowed this to be in the Bible. I don't know. It relates with that one culture. But I think, too, that God's ways of acting are so out of the norm. And he never does the same thing twice, it seems. Because he doesn't want us to trust in the form of religion. You know, we get so accustomed to the form of religion. Sit down, stand up, light the candle, do this, do that. We have our forms, and we trust a form. And the Lord basically just kind of blows the minds of the disciples. Just when they figure something out, he does something different. Because it's not the method. It's the message. And I think in many ways that, look, there's all kinds of denominations today because we have differences about little minor things. But those who truly love Jesus, they're welcome at my table any day. Whatever denomination they come from, if they truly have surrendered to the Lord Jesus, they're family. Though we might have little differences here or there, you know, because sometimes we get caught up in the methodologies of doing things a certain way. And, you know, if there were different denominations that came out of this, you know, maybe, you know, Jesus healed somebody by touching them, so you got the church of "He touched me" started, you know, and here's the church of "The finger in the ear." Here's the church of "He spat," or "Here's mud in your eye." When you remember, he made the little spittle, he put mud. The church of "Here's mud in your eye," that would be kind of a cool name, wouldn't it? Draw some crowds, I imagine. Wonder what in the world is this? But you know, whatever it is, I think God works differently, even in your own experience. Some of you had a dramatic conversion, immediately touched. You knew immediately something changed. Others of you, it was gradual. For me, it was gradual. I had an initial sense that something's different, a lightness of my heart, but then it was like it was months before I realized something happened in me. I'm not the same. And so our experience is different, and I think what we want to do is not quantify that as much, but ultimately come to the conclusion, you see, he has done all things well. Whether it's being harsh with this woman, apparently, but yet for a purpose. And sometimes in our own experience, he has to bring us to that place. Or whether he touches us immediately, he does all things well. My Lord Jesus does all things well. He has the power to reach right now into the hearts of those that have been abused by this world, twisted by sin, defiled by whatever, and he can change that heart my Lord and Savior Jesus does all things well. If you'll submit to Him, if you'll believe. These people that brought this deaf man, they believed. This woman, desperate enough to believe, even being humbled, yet still believed, and was looking for at least a crumb that would fall from the table. And I tell you, when you have that heart to say, okay, Lord, I surrender. You know, from the loftiest communication with God, it brings the deepest sympathy, and this groaning that Jesus does and looking up to heaven is such a beautiful picture of a perfect man, and this is how we should be, looking heavenward with a groan in our spirit over the sin that we see. I'll tell you, you go forth in ministry with that, and there's going to be power. When you're touched by the iniquity and the sin and the hurt and the pain in the world, and it, you don't hide yourself from it, but you delve into it, whether it's in a mission that you go on or whether you're committed to make a difference. I know some are, you know, just committed to help somehow in some way, in some measure of form, the growing sex trafficking among people. And it's just tragic how our world has given themselves over to such debauchery and evil. And that there might even have been some here that were once the purveyors of that, or at least the consumers of that. But some little girl somewhere have been abused, thrown into a situation, now she has to sell her body. And I mean, it's just horrendous because it's by the thousands, hundreds of thousands. And this ought not to be. But again, that's just one little tiny bit of the pain in this world. What do we do with that? I'll tell you what. Looking heavenward, groaning in your spirit. Being what Jesus wants you to be and making a difference and touching lives. Who can tell what God can do in changing a soul?